Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start with something rather astonishing. Frankenlungs, very Halloween-y sort of thing to be talking about in October. Damaged lungs restored by connection to a living pig. Now, donated lungs are a big deal. A lot of lungs that are donated for transplant are too damaged to be used. And this is a problem because they only survive after being removed from, let's say, a brain-dead person for a couple of hours. And they can just about 28% of donated lungs currently meet the criteria for transplantation. The others are, well, basically starting to die, and you don't want to put starting to die tissue into a transplant patient. And doctors have tried to use what's called EVLP, extra vivo lung perfusion, a little bit like ENCO, which you may have learned about, which is used in place of ventilators in COVID patients. And these ELVP devices plump oxygenated air and fluid through the lungs, but even then, they weren't really able to get the survival rate up high enough. So a doctor, Gordana Vunjak-Novakovic at Columbia University, New York, had a great idea, Frankenlungs. She wondered whether the lungs might do better if they were connected to a living body with, growth factors and antibodies and white blood cells and other working organs that would be able to deliver nutrients and remove harmful substances and flush them away. So to find out, the team obtained lungs from 6 human donors that had been rejected for transplant, and one lung had failed after 5 hours on an EVLP device and had been outside of the body for a day before the team retrieved it. So they took these lungs and they connected them to the circulatory system of an anesthetized pig for 24 hours with tubes feeding the blood vessels of the human lung running from those in the pig's neck. At the same time, the lung was pumped with air using a ventilator and immunosuppressant drugs, which prevent foreign tissues from being rejected by the immune system, were introduced into both the pig and the lung. I want to quickly point out that the pigs are fine. The procedure did not seem to have any lasting effects on the pigs after they woke up with anesthesia. In one experiment, they were actually able to move around, play with toys, and eat while connected to a device used to support lungs taken from other pigs. Before the new treatment, all the lungs had a lot of white areas, which is what ischemic dead tissue looks like, and they weren't capable, because of that, of getting enough oxygen into the person's blood. But after 24 hours to the pigs, the lungs looked transformed. A range of tests showed that their cells, tissue structure, and capacity to deliver oxygen had significantly improved. Even though the lungs had been outside of the body by this time for almost 2 days, even those lungs seemed to recover. It's really remarkable. They aren't 100% normal, but they're close enough for rock and roll and transplant. The lungs looked healthy enough for a transplant, but we want to emphasize they were not used. There are going to be more experiments before we start transplanting these treated lungs into people. And it's also important to realize that pigs can harbor harmful pathogens that could be transmitted into people. So they're only going to use medical-grade pigs. And I assume that those are pigs who were raised in a sterile environment, who go through extensive viral testing. The lungs, however, may not be entirely free of pig cells. And some of the white blood cells were found to remain, and these could trigger an immune reaction in a lung recipient. However, most of these lung recipients would be also receiving anti-immune drugs to prevent rejection. And also, Dr. Vunjak-Novakovic has this other idea that maybe you could use the person's own blood supply to revive the donated lungs and just let the pigs do the pumping, so to speak. Interesting science, and as I said, perfect for Halloween. I guess maybe I should have called them zombie lungs, but hey, I might be getting myself one of those one day, and I certainly don't want to jinx myself. So we are moving to emails, and as I said, a lot of emails today, and I want to be sure that I acknowledge those who emailed me by trying to get them a quick answer. So let's start with Marilyn in Santa Cruz. What is the science behind vitamin supplement recommendations for dry macular degeneration? Dear Dr. Dawn, my 86-year-old mother has been diagnosed with stable dry macular degeneration. The doctor recommended taking supplements, this would be Ocuvite or another brand name of that, containing copper, zinc, xanthan, that's astaxanthin actually, vitamin C, vitamin D, and lutein. These are all compounds which are in general carotenoids for the names that you don't recognize. Those are carotenoids, the lovely pigments in leaves and flamingos and goldfish that give them their wonderful orange color. And carotenoids are similar to chlorophyll in that they absorb light, visible light, and they are useful to the plant as sunscreen. They're also really potent, as you might expect, really potent antioxidants. And this comes out of a great deal of research, Marilyn, going back almost 20 years now, so I wasn't able to quickly find references to tell you about, but I was there out in the trenches treating patients when this was discovered and the effort, and it became standard of care to use vitamin supplements to actually treat a disease that wasn't scurvy. She eats a lot of fruits and vegetables daily and has never been a believer in supplements unless there is a diagnosed deficiency. She's inclined to ignore the recommendation. Is there any science behind these recommendations? Well, yes, there is. And if you were to simply go to scholar.google.com, and I'll be giving someone else a lesson in this later on, and type in dry macular degeneration and vitamins, you will see some of the very persuasive science showing that these prevent progression. Now, she has stable degeneration. That's a little bit like being a stable genius. It's subject to change without notice. And so I want to emphasize the importance of follow-up, even though your mother is, you know, everything else that's going on, your mom does not want to go blind. She does not want to be legally blind. I guarantee it. It's not as hard as it used to be, what with computers that read your letters to you, but it is still hard. So you want to protect that vision, and it is very scientifically based. P.S. I love your show. I've listened since 2012, and I've been a huge podcast fan ever since I attended your in-person show at Cruise.io, where you and the geeks demonstrated how to listen to podcasts. Thank you for that somewhat life-changing and enriching event. How about that, folks? It's only 8 years ago that most people were unfamiliar with podcasts, unless you were a geek, and we started reaching out to the community in a new and different way. It has been truly wonderful, and I am very grateful for this technology. Our next email comes from Rebecca in Sunnyvale. I'm going to read the whole thing because Rebecca has done something I love, which is she's corrected something I said on the air. I wanted to reach out in follow-up regarding dietary recommendations for calcium oxalate kidney stones. Not all stone formers have elevated oxalate or elevated calcium in their urine. This I know. Therefore, not all will have to restrict oxalate or calcium. Those who do have hyperoxaluria can benefit from calcium taken with meals to bind dietary oxalate, like what you find in spinach, so that the oxalate is excreted in stool rather than urine. Calcium loves oxalate. Those with elevated calcium in the urine should have evaluation as to the cause, including a check of parathyroid hormone and possibly 1,25-hydroxyvitamin D and levels of sodium and protein breakdown products in the urine. High sodium and high protein diets can both cause elevated urinary calcium independent of calcium intake. I'd suggest the caller may benefit from 2 24-hour urine collections to assess his specific risk factors for stone formation, and so he can avoid unnecessary dietary restrictions. I very much agree that hydration is key. Well, thank you very much, Rebecca. You didn't give me your credentials, but just by your language and use of terminology. I will stand corrected, and thank you for the correction. One question I have for myself would be if you or your listeners can recommend a non-toxic, environmentally friendly laundry detergent that is effective in eliminating odors from sweaty clothes. I bet Rebecca exercises as well. Thank you for your pursuit of ongoing inquiry and sharing from your reading and experience. I'm going to come down with ECOS, E-C-O-S, which is no scent, no nothing, just a mild and low-sudsing detergent that cleans very well, gets my sweat clothes clean, my gym clothes and my running shirts and all those things that are pretty whiffy when I put them in. And also, I like the laundry detergent made by Seventh Generation. I know this sounds like a Pinterest thing, but if you put some vinegar in the wash, if you're not getting it to stop stinking with just the soap, try adding a little bit more soap and about a half a cup of vinegar per load. White vinegar, I think, is better than red wine, but, to your taste, madame, and see what you get. I think that is a good answer to a good question. Let's move on to another email. This from Ellen in San Francisco. Short one with a long answer. Dear Dr. Dawn, I have symptoms of celiac disease, and I would like to know treatment options and natural remedies to use. All right. Well, let's start with just a topic sentence, which is that celiac may be the only disease without a drug attached to it. Very occasionally, steroids are used. But for the most part, celiac disease is, number one, more common than we realize. Number two, difficult to diagnose. And number three, treatable by dietary restriction. But one of my very dear friends has celiac disease, the real deal, and that dietary restriction is onerous. So for your sake, Ellen, I really hope that you have not got celiac disease. So we first have to establish what symptoms you're referring to, because celiac disease can cause an irritable bowel syndrome, and I'm hoping that's what you have, because there are other strategies for us there. But if you have weight loss, diarrhea, and low iron, then we have to worry that you either have celiac disease, Crohn's disease, or ulcerative colitis. And if you're not seeing blood, then the first one becomes more likely. There is also a condition called non-celiac gluten intolerance. And this is much more common than has been previously supposed. It is, however, now recognized. There have been several articles in the mainstream medical literature, so it is now officially a thing. And it is irritable bowel syndrome with either constipation or diarrhea, abdominal cramping, bloating, and pain. Also sometimes early satiety and nausea, although those are much rarer. And this gets better when the person avoids gluten. So if you've got that, then you by definition have a gluten intolerance of some sort and quite likely non-celiac gastrointestinal disease. So let's move to diagnosis. It's difficult to diagnose because the quote-unquote gold standard is to get a probe down into the small intestine and take a piece of flesh from the inside of your intestine and look at it under a microscope. If you do that, what you will see is, well, I heard a wonderful metaphor once at a functional medicine conference. It was, think about your 1970s shag rug, right? The big long furs, very soft, and fuzzy, and totally out of fashion now. Okay, that's what the normal intestinal lining looks like, a big 1970s shag rug. And if you have celiac disease, you got Berber carpeting, very short, very flat, and more like a mat than a carpet. Now, the problem with Berber is surface area. In a healthy intestine, every one of those shags is actually an absorptive organ with a lot of surface area that's sucking in nutrients and pumping out digestive juice in order to break up and suck in more nutrients. Now, when you trim those off into a crew cut,
you can't absorb the nutrients. Hence the weight loss, which is a prominent feature, and the inability to gain weight, and also the diarrhea, because you're leaving a lot of things, so to speak, on the table rather than absorbing them. People will also get other symptoms. This is an autoimmune disease where you are damaging the gut, so you get secondary problems with that. Besides the vitamin deficiencies and the weight loss, you get a inflamed gut, which alters your microbiome. And you also get a raw gut. And the raw gut is like having an open wound. And if you have an open wound and signals, we call them chemical signals or antigens from food, are exposed to the flesh underneath that Berber carpeting, then the immune system, which is right there ready to protect any wound, of course, because, you know, you're always scratching up the inside of your intestine and making wounds, and they heal really fast. But in the meantime, the immune system keeps all that bacteria out of your bloodstream. So it's just lined with guard posts of immune cells. Just under that layer that we just wounded with our autoimmune attack. So now you'll start making antibodies to other food. And before you know it, you may have multiple food sensitivities related to IgG antibody. IgG is the one that you get with vaccinations. So people with celiac are literally vaccinated against many common foods that they eat. So now they just don't just have celiac disease. They have celiac plus all of these other food reactions. So to diagnose this, I often use antibody testing, and the Mayo Clinic has a deaminated gliadin antibody test, which is, that is one of the most accurate. You need an IgA against endomysium, and you need an IgA against, an IgG against gliadin and tissue transglutaminase. Tissue transglutaminase, why that? Because that's a normal enzyme that people with celiac always develop an antibody against. So if you've got those antibodies positive, you've got about an 85% chance you actually have celiac disease. But if you have them negative, it doesn't really prove that you don't have celiac disease. And you can do genetic testing if it's in your family. There have been studies looking at tissue surface markers. These are the tissue HLA antigens, what we use for organ transplant matching. And there are two, DLQ2 and DLQH. You'll sometimes see that abbreviated DQ2 and DQH. And if you have these, if you inherited these, you've got about a 15% chance of having light celiac disease by the age of two. And then it mostly gets better because the immune system matures. But then during periods of stress, if you carb load, particularly I had one classmate in medical school who I traveled to China with, and he had celiac disease, and it was very hard for him because everything has soy sauce in it, and soy sauce has gluten. So the poor guy just lived on white rice while we were eating all this banquet food. It was, you know, really, really hard for him. This is back in the 80s when you didn't have a lot of options when you were eating at a restaurant in China, at least not they're gluten-free. What's that? Anyway, getting back to treatment now. The first thing is avoidance. There are food, the labeling now, if it's gluten-free, it'll say gluten-free. If it was processed in a factory that also processed gluten, it'll say that. By the way, my friend is such a canary that he can't even eat a gluten-free meal if it was prepared in a kitchen where they have gluten-containing products, because even a molecule floating around in the air in landing on his food is enough to set him off. After that, what we do in functional medicine is we run an IgG panel, G as in George, to look for other food sensitivities, and we eliminate those foods from the person's diet. We use bovine colostrum, which is the pre-milk before the cow starts to lactate. Humans do this too, but you can purchase bovine colostrum, and it is IgG, and it binds to pathogens. So it's useful for healing the gut. We use probiotics, a lot of gut anti-inflammatories, and we use L-glutamine, which is an amino acid that helps heal the intestines. and particularly the cells of the small intestine. So by giving the compounds needed for healing, we can make a big, big difference. And I also want to say that the probiotics need to be done by a functional medicine doctor, someone who's trained in nuanced management of the gut flora, because you have to time this when you do it, and you have to use the right probiotics, and you can't just head down to the health food store and buy these supplements because the clerk told you these were the doses and really expect to get anywhere. So first comes diagnosis, then comes checking for antibodies and taking anti-inflammatories and substrates for healing, and avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. As a last resort, people have done fecal transplants and reported success. Fecal transplants are hard to get in the United States. They're not approved for celiac at this moment. However, I think that there might be a study you could get into, but it won't matter. All the king's horses and all the king's men will not work. If you really have celiac, you've got to do the dietary manipulation. There really is, literally, no magic drug, you know, from whatever Genentech that's going to fix you. I'm really sorry to break that news. Let's hope you don't have it and have the other kinder, gentler variety of gluten sensitivity. That one, at least, is more manageable. I just want to read one more email, and this one from Jacqueline in Santa Cruz. I've been eating fish on four times a week, mainly wild salmon, cod, halibut, tilapia, and canned herring, which are all listed as relatively low mercury. However, not only do I eat frequently, but also in larger portions beyond the recommendation, about 12 ounces each time. I am fully breastfeeding my 16-week-old and concerned beyond my own health. Do you recommend a specific test, blood, urine, and would the cost be covered by insurance? I have a good one, Cigna. Well, you should start with getting a urine, heavy metals, and get a first morning urine. So that means you're going to get a specimen jar from the lab or from your doctor and pee into that and have them run your first morning urine. And if there's any mercury in there, and I mean any, then you need to get a provoked urine test, which, unless you're in an HMO, will run you about $75, and it'll run you twice that if you're in an HMO. And what a provoked test would do, you'd have to stop breastfeeding for one day, so you could pump and bottle feed for a day, is it would tell you what your overall mercury load is. And you'd need someone like myself or another functional medicine doctor to help you interpret it. But if you've got a big load of mercury, I would recommend switching away from fish or just doing freshwater fish during the time that you're breastfeeding. You're right to be avoiding tuna, swordfish, the big predator fish like shark. Those are all much higher in mercury, and right to be using wild salmon and cod. You want to stay away from farmed fish in general. So I'm a little worried about tilapia because that's usually farmed, but that's a different thing. You don't want the runoffs because many of the pesticides and fertilizers contain compounds that we wouldn't want to be bioconcentrating in an infant. So don't just start eating a ton of tilapia if you switch away from the others. Hope that's helpful. Another email from our Santa Cruz community. This one from Lisa in Santa Cruz. Long hauler syndrome post-COVID. Who are the scientific leaders studying the long hauler syndrome post-COVID infection? Which therapeutic approaches are gaining evidence for effective management of this syndrome, or is it too early to know? Are there cases where the patient seemed to fully recover from the initial infection and weeks or months later developed unexplained dizziness, brain fog, and fatigue? It seems like most descriptions of the syndrome do not include relatively long asymptomatic periods in between the initial infection and the post-viral syndrome. Many thanks. Well, Lisa, I want to say thank you for the question. I did do a search, and I was not surprised to find that I came up pretty dry in terms of research. There isn't much published because of the nature of publication and the lag time that it takes. So therefore, there really is no one person or place that has emerged. We're thinking, in terms of what we're talking about, after common symptoms of COVID, as you probably know, are cough, fever, shortness of breath,
joint pain, GI symptoms, and loss of smell. But there isn't a lot known about persistent syndromes. This is an Italian university in Rome, and it established a post-acute outpatient service back in April. And they did publish data in a Journal of the American Medical Association letter on follow-up studies. So they, first of all, these are all people who have contracted COVID, and they received various types of symptomatic treatments. And they used a standardized questionnaire. So here's what I can tell you. They had 179 patients during the hospitalization, and this is just people who were identified, so not the light cases. So these were hospitalized people. Most of them were short of breath. They were looked at again 60 days, 2 months after the onset. And at that point, out of the 180 patients, only 18, that's about 12%, were completely free of COVID-related symptoms. 32% had several symptoms, and 55% had three or more, but none of them had fever. A lot of them continued to have severe fatigue, about half, dyspnea, which is shortness of breath, about 40%, almost, 43.4%, 27% with joint pain, and 21% with chest pain. So that, I would say, is the typical course, persistence. And so we're up to 87% of people with at least one of these symptoms, particularly shortness of breath and fatigue. And those patients that I know who have had COVID often would have tachycardia and shortness of breath, sometimes with a very normal oxygen and sometimes with a low oxygen, and problems with exercising. So far, we're 4 months out from the first case I know, and that person has, as far as they can tell, fully recovered. But we just don't have the data to give you the answers to your questions. Right now, it's looking very much like something called meningoencephalitis chronic fatigue inflammatory distress syndrome. And what this is an abbreviation for a syndrome, meaning it's not a disease. It's something that we see in many people after Lyme disease. We see it in people after various types of mold exposures. Some people appear to be canaries in the coal mine and get it from a heavy EMF exposure. When you measure antibodies in these people, you'll often see elevated antibodies to Epstein-Barr virus, which is the mononucleosis virus, or you'll see elevated antibodies to cytomegalovirus, another common viral infection. You'll often see anti-nuclear antibody, which would be what we would see in lupus, but the levels are non-specific, and the titers, which is to say the concentration of the antibodies, isn't that high. It's usually maybe four times the upper limit of normal. Still quite abnormal, but not at the levels we see with these actual disease syndromes. In functional medicine, we think this represents an exaggerated immune response, an immune response that has basically gotten out of control and is now just on overdrive. And if you can think of that cytokine storm as a severe version of this, this is the low level grass fire as opposed to the full on the mountains are burning firestorm fires like the ones we're having still having in many places in California. My heart goes out to those poor people up in Santa Rosa. My heart goes out to everyone who's lost their homes. But if you want to think of that as massive inflammation that kills you, you can think of this as low-grade inflammation that makes you occasionally wish you were dead. And of course, there's lots of with chronic inflammation, there's also lots of psychological symptoms, brain fog and fatigue. And yes, this doesn't have to roll in to COVID. Nobody has had COVID very long ago at this point, right? And we got our first cases, I think, in March in this community. So they're 4 months out. And there have been some people who have
appear to be manifesting late, but they maybe have something else going on. And it's way too soon to tell. So it's an interesting question. Stay tuned. As more good quality data comes out, I'll be happy to give that to you. I'm going to take a couple of minutes to celebrate an important milestone for me. And that is the two women who won, who, among other things, they're the third and fourth women to win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry ever. That's pretty cool. And they are also the first people to ever to get the Nobel Prize in less than 10 years for their discovery. And that happened because their discovery has rocked our world. It is the biggest bomb in chemistry, in biology, in basically in, since the discovery of the germ theory of disease, and that is CRISPR, the ability to cut and paste DNA across species, across individuals, the ability to heal genetic disease, the ability to actually fix family lines. You can fix hemophilia, and the children are fixed. That nobody imagined ever that this would be possible, but it is possible. It's also very scary. Jennifer's up in Berkeley, and Manuel, I think, may be back at her home university at this point, but both ladies deserve applause and a brava for their beautiful scientific work, and also a hiss and a boo to the guy, the postdoc, who stole the patent and took it to the Broad Institute at Harvard. I'll just say it because I'm still angry about that. Don't go stealing people's patents. I'm glad they got the Nobel Prize, but I wish they'd gotten the patent too. Before I go, I'd like to ask your support for Ask Dr. Dawn by supporting the incredible startup community radio station that broadcasts my show from Santa Cruz, California, KSQD. This station is run 100% by volunteers and is 100% funded by listener donations. As you've heard recently during the intense California fires, many people have lost their homes or are otherwise somewhat strapped financially. KSQD performed amazingly during the fires. They have a mission of community service, as well as an amazing mix of public service news and discussion shows and a very wide, eclectic mix of music shows. Yes, this is a local Santa Cruz radio station, but all of their shows are streamed on the internet live and available via modern archived capabilities to anyone on the planet. So, if you like Ask Dr. Dawn, you should check out ksqd.org. When you are there, you can easily donate any amount you can to keep this station alive, as they are critical to continue to bring you Ask Dr. Dawn. Please help if you can. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.